This week on Two-Way Street, the author of a new book on Jimmy Carter reveals how Carter's born-again faith informed every aspect of his political life.
And he said the first understanding of his understanding of justice was informed by the very famous Protestant theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, who often said that the sad duty of politics was to render justice in a sinful world. Then he said his second understanding of justice came from the other theologian, Bob Dylan.
And then we'll give you a preview of a new production of a classic musical that's being staged in the rolling hills of South Fulton County. Just the setting for a musical about farmers and cowhands.
We're using an actual barn that was built in 1905. We're using live horses. We're going to have an actual horse-drawn surrey at the end.
I'm Bill Nigut. That's coming up on Two-Way Street. This past week marked the anniversary of a major political milestone that thrust Georgia into the national spotlight and has kept us there ever since. On July 15, 1976, Jimmy Carter strode to the podium at the Democratic National Convention in Madison Square Garden in New York to accept the Democratic nomination for President of the United States.
My name is Jimmy Carter, and I'm running for president.
It was the culmination of a grassroots campaign that took Carter from complete unknown to the heights of national prominence. Now, in a new biography, esteemed Dartmouth historian Randall Balmer describes the way in which Carter's born-again Christian beliefs influenced every aspect of his political career. And Balmer breaks new ground by tracing the evolution of evangelicism as a national political movement, starting as a progressive force for change when Carter first ran for president, and moving to the right as his presidency unfolded. Randall Balmer is the head of the Department of Religion at Dartmouth. He's also an Episcopal priest and has written more than a dozen books. We talked to him in our studio recently. It's interesting that you point out in your book that even as Jimmy Carter became a public figure early in his career, the term that we used was not typically evangelical, was it? What did we call them?
Born again. And Billy Graham often, probably most often, referred to himself as born again. And it's really with Jimmy Carter's presidential campaign that the term evangelical becomes part of the lexicon, the general lexicon of American religion. Before that time, Carter himself certainly referred to himself as born again. Graham, as I said, did the same. And his campaign really introduces that term to the American public.
Let's talk about what that means.
First, I would say, is an understanding of the Bible as God's revelation to humanity. And evangelicals very often, as a corollary, seek to interpret the Bible literally, although, as I've written elsewhere, they engage in what I call the ruse of selective literalism. I think everybody does, even people who are devout. The second general characteristic is somebody who believes in the centrality of a conversion or a born-again experience. And this derives from the third chapter of St. John in the New Testament, when Nicodemus, a Jewish leader, visits Jesus by night to ask how he can gain admission to the kingdom of heaven. And Jesus replies in the King James Version, "You must be born again." So that's where the term comes from, is born again. And for most evangelicals, that's a dramatic, very often, not always, but a dramatic moment, a dateable experience when they can point back to a particular date, you know, June 17th, 1982, when I gave my heart to Jesus or I became born again. I would say, and Carter himself has said, that his born again moment came when he was 11 years old back in Plains in 1935 when he responded to a preacher and gave his heart to Jesus. This is language that evangelicals use to describe this experience, and he was baptized into the Plains Baptist Church. The third general characteristic is somebody who takes seriously what evangelicals call the Great Commission. At the end of the Gospel of Mark, Jesus instructs his followers to go into all the world and preach the gospel. And so most evangelicals would take seriously the mandate to evangelize or to bring others into the fold. I do observe, however, over the last 50 years or so, that evangelicals typically hire professionals to do it for them. That is, they will support missionaries or they'll have a visitation minister on the staff of a megachurch or something.
you do point out that that wasn't Jimmy Carter. He was the real deal.
He was the real deal, and I think that's one of the things that in many ways sets him apart and certainly burnishes his credentials as an evangelical. The fact that on at least two occasions he engaged in forthrightly evangelistic activities, going door to door, telling people about Jesus. In fact, the first time I met Carter was here in Atlanta at Emory University, and what he wanted to talk about was what he called the unsurpassed joy of telling people about Christ. And that was so important to him that it dominated the conversation.
So let's start with the Carter career itself. One of the things that I did not know that you pointed out is that he really wasn't born again until after he lost.
Yeah, this is the first race for governor in 1960. I think we can probably play with the terminology here. I would probably use language in 1967 after that first campaign for governor to the effect that this was a rededication or a revitalization of his faith. And this does seem to be really the pivotal experience for him in terms of his faith, because shortly thereafter he goes on a mission trip to Lock Haven, Pennsylvania with other Southern Baptist laymen, and he knocks on doors to tell people about Jesus. And later that same year he does the same in Springfield, Massachusetts. So I think the 1967 experience, I probably wouldn't say that was his born-again experience, but it was certainly a time when he revisited that experience, that moment, and revitalized his faith.
With that in mind, okay, so let's back up again. Jimmy Carter marries Rosalynn. He goes into the Navy, and he's left the farm. Where he grew up without very much of anything. They were a poor family in Middle Georgia.
That's right.
When he left to go off and join the Navy.
Earl
Carter dies. His father dies. Been a heavy smoker all his life, and it finally takes his life. And Jimmy Carter turns to Rosalynn and says, "The Navy is not going to be my profession. I need to go back to Plains and run the farm."
Rosalynn was not amused.
There was talk of divorce at that point for a short period of time. I think a lot of people here would be very surprised by that.
And apparently the car trip from Schenectady, New York, where they were stationed at the time, down to Plains, Georgia, transpired in almost total silence between these two very, very strong-willed individuals. But I think it's worth coming back to an earlier part of that question. And one of the things that surprised me when I was writing the biography is to realize that the real formative influence on Jimmy Carter's life and his moral sense came not from his mother, Miss Lillian, who many people remember because she was such a fixture during his campaign for the presidency in 1976, but from his father. Mm-hmm. And it was standing at his father's bedside in 1953 when Mr. Earl, as he was known, was dying, that profoundly affected Jimmy Carter. And what he saw was that people in the community, people that Jimmy Carter never knew, or perhaps knew only in passing, came by the hospital room to pay their respects to Mr. Earl and to thank him for very quiet acts of kindness and generosity that he had demonstrated toward them, giving a family money for new clothes so they could celebrate their daughter's graduation from high school, carrying the mortgage for a family in financial difficulty, extending credit from the Carter store so that a poor family could make it through a rough patch. And that profoundly affected Jimmy Carter, and that's what led to his decision to resign his commission from the Navy and return to Plains over Rosalynn's objections.
And we should say he did this, in many cases, across racial lines at a time in the South when no one did that.
Mr. Earl was not, Jimmy Carter's father was not overtly and demonstrably desegregationist. I think he still observed the kind of mores of Southern white behavior at the time, but he certainly indulged in Lillian's gestures of charity and compassion toward African Americans. And in his own quiet way, he did that as well.
When Jimmy Carter returned to Plains, segregation was in its full-blown force in the South. Did Jimmy Carter adhere to the segregationist lines that the community around him did?
He very emphatically and forcefully refused to join the White Citizens Council, which I'm sure folks know was considered the Uptown Klan after the Brown v. Board of Education ruling of 1954. But Carter returned to Plains at that moment, in 1954, when the Brown decision was issued on May 17, 1954. And so he had to deal with the changing racial sensibilities there in the Deep South. It wasn't easy for a lot of white Southerners to countenance these changes. And I think Carter certainly was ahead of his fellow white Southerners for the most part.
You tell a really good story about the White Citizens Council. They pressured him over and over again to join. It cost $5 to join. And at one point they came to him and he pulled out $5. What happened?
He pulled out a $5 bill and he said, "I'll flush this down the toilet before I give you this money to join the White Citizens Council." Now, I'm going to add to that story. I'm sure he did not do that. Jimmy Carter was a very frugal man, as you know, but he made his point.
This was an act of some courage.
Because the explicit threat on the part of people associated with the White Citizens Council was that his business would be boycotted. And in fact, it was. And a couple of families did stay permanently away from the Carter warehouse, but he was able to weather that economic boycott.
He became a member of the school board, where he did care about the trying to enact the Brown v. Board of Education ruling. But, of course, in 1954, very few states in the South were paying attention to Brown v. Board of Education. They were still looking for every opportunity they could to resist, and that happened in Georgia as well.
It did, and Carter talks about, during his time on the Sumter County Board of Education, becoming aware of the radical disparities between white and black schools.
Well, this is a good moment to talk about what Carter's born-again beliefs meant to him as a social activist, if we can use that word. Because you talk a lot about that. What was the spirit that born-again Christians brought to social change, to the need to lift up the poorest among us, as it were, in those days?
There's a strain in American history that I call progressive evangelicalism, going back to the 19th century. People like Charles Grandison Finney and many other evangelical leaders were very much concerned about the issue of slavery, obviously in the North. This would be concentrated in the North, the abolitionist movement. But they were also interested in, for example, public education, known as common schools in the 19th century, as a device to try to lift up those on the bottom rungs of society and make them upwardly mobile so they could have a better life. They were very much interested in equality for women, including voting rights, which in the 19th century, of course, was a rather radical idea. And I contend in the book that Jimmy Carter picked up a lot of these things amid a resurgence of this progressive evangelicalism in the early part of the 1970s. And he echoes a lot of these same themes in his approach to governing as governor of Georgia, but then later as president. I think one of the remarkable instances for Jimmy Carter's articulation of these principles came here in Georgia at the University of Georgia Law Day at Athens in the May of 1974. And there, Jimmy Carter, he gets up to address the gathering, and he talks about his understanding of justice and where that came from. And he said the first understanding of his understanding of justice was informed by the very famous Protestant theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, who often said that the sad duty of politics was to render justice in a sinful world. And Carter repeated that many times throughout his life and his political career. But then he said his second understanding of justice came from the other theologian, and this one was Bob Dylan, and particularly Dylan's song, Ain't Gonna Work on Maggie's Farm No More. Being a tenant farmer was not an easy life, and Carter came away from that with the understanding that we really do have to care for the poor and the least of these in society, those people Jesus called the least of these in the New Testament.
Niebuhr was a great influence on him. He singled him out as the philosopher whose writings influenced him most heavily. Tell us a little bit about Niebuhr.
Reinhold Niebuhr was you probably call him a theological liberal before World War I, when he realized that it was necessary to resist evil in the world. And Niebuhr has often been quoted by various theologians, including Barack Obama, by the way, as being very influential in their understanding of politics. So, for example, Niebuhr said that violence is bad, and one of the Ten Commandments says, thou shalt not kill. I mean, I think everybody knows that. But that evil sometimes is so rampant and so pernicious that it was not only justifiable, but incumbent upon the believer to engage in violence in order to resist evil.
I'm talking with Randall Balmer. He's a Dartmouth College professor and an Episcopal priest whose new book, Redeemer, The Life of Jimmy Carter, focuses on how Jimmy Carter's born-again beliefs informed his entire political career. We'll be right back. I'm talking with Randall Balmer about his new book, Redeemer, The Life of Jimmy Carter. Balmer is head of the religion department at Dartmouth College. As we pick up the conversation, Balmer is talking about Carter's 1970 run for governor.
The 1970 campaign for governor is not a pretty sight. It's really a tawdry campaign, and Carter does court the segregationist vote. There's very, very compelling evidence that Carter himself was very, very uncomfortable with that campaign. Toward the end of the campaign, he told Vernon Jordan, at that time head of the United Negro College Fund, you won't like my campaign, but you will like my administration. So even before the campaign was over, he was apologizing. In some ways, in writing the biography, as I really began to look into the 1970 campaign, I was very uncomfortable with that because I had thought much better of Jimmy Carter. But it makes him more human in some ways, I think, and makes him more accessible as somebody who has faults and we all have regrets.
He atoned on Inauguration Day.
He did.
What did he say in his inaugural speech?
He said very famously, and this got picked up by the national press, he said, the time for racial segregation is over. And that's picked up by the New York Times the following morning, above the fold on the front page. And then several weeks later, Carter's face appears on the cover of Time magazine as a representative of the so-called New South, together with Reuben Askew of Florida and Dale Bumpers. But it's Carter's image that is on the cover of Time magazine, and that helps to catapult him to national attention.
Yes, but we should point out once again that here in the state of Georgia, it took a certain amount of courage, even in 1970, to be willing to say it's time for us to come together across racial lines.
It did. And the other gesture he made, which was certainly symbolic but important, was to have portraits of African Americans hung in the State House. And, of course, one of them was Martin Luther King Jr., which didn't set well with a lot of segregationists here in Georgia.
So, Rosalynn Carter, you write that there are hints as early as 1971 and that Rosalynn Carter drops in her autobiography that Carter, they're thinking about the White House. Rosalynn says basically that, right?
Yeah, she says why not, in effect. And Carter himself says why not. And one of the reasons for that is that a parade of Democratic presidential possibilities comes through Atlanta, and many of them stay in the governor's mansion. People like Scoop Jackson of Washington and George McGovern of South Dakota, Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts, and many others. And Carter is underwhelmed. He says, you know, if these guys can run for president, why can't I? And so almost immediately after they move into the White House, Jimmy and Rosalynn Carter begin, into the governor's mansion, Jimmy and Rosalynn Carter begin talking about the possibility of mounting a campaign for president.
And his evangelical nature meant that he was promoting progressive social causes as well, yes?
He was. And I think that's one of the things I try to argue in the book, is that Carter's improbable run for the presidency was abetted by the confluence of this resurgence of progressive evangelicalism, but also his reputation as a New South governor, that is, a post-racial governor. And those two streams came together, and he rode that current to the White House.
So early on, when he talked about being born again, nobody paid much attention because I think there was a survey you point out in the book, or a poll of candidates that people wanted to see run, and some 35 names emerged, and Carter wasn't even on that list.
Right. That was a month before he announced his candidacy.
Okay, but he wins the Iowa caucus, he wins the New Hampshire primary, he comes to North Carolina, which in those days had an early primary, he wins there, and suddenly the national media is paying attention to Jimmy Carter.
They are paying attention, and I happen to think that one of the real accomplishments of Jimmy Carter, for which he does not get enough credit, is the fact that on March 9th, 1976, in the Florida primary, he effectively terminates the political career of the nation's most notorious segregationist, George Wallace of Alabama. Carter thereby rid both his party and the nation of its most pugnacious segregationist.
So all of a sudden he's on the radar, and now the media is listening to him. And at a certain point, he talks again about being born again. There's an incident, as I recall, that you point out in the book.
Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's a backyard event, and somebody in the audience asks him if he was a born-again Christian, and Carter, of course, said yes. It was the most natural response in the world. He didn't even think twice about it. But the national media were there, and that really hit the presses. As I say very often, when Carter made that declaration of being a born-again Christian, he sent every New York journalist to his Rolodex to figure out what in the world he was talking about. But the important point is that many evangelicals around the nation, if not all of them, recognized that he was one of their own, that he was a born-again Christian, and that they took notice. And he really does help to bring them into the political process.
Yeah, and some rallied to his side, not all. Billy Graham, who had brought Richard Nixon to heights that maybe Nixon may never have achieved as a presidential candidate, was not particularly impressed with Jimmy Carter at that point.
The relationship between Jimmy Carter and Billy Graham is really fascinating, and I don't pretend to understand all the ins and outs of it. But Graham, I have to say, and I say this with some reluctance, because I've always been an admirer of Billy Graham. In fact, I did a PBS documentary about Billy Graham. But Graham, let me say this gently, pushed the boundaries of credibility in terms of his relationship with Jimmy Carter, both in 1976 and especially in 1980.
How did he do that?
Billy Graham made representations to Carter himself, as well as to Carter's staff members, that belied Graham's actual behavior and his comportment. That is to say, that Graham made assurances to Carter and his staff that he would stay out of the politics of the political race in 1980 in particular, and then turned around and called Paul Laxalt, who was Reagan's campaign chairman, and offered to do whatever he could to elect Ronald Reagan as president in 1980.
I'd really like to explore another fascinating aspect of what you talk about in the book. When Jimmy Carter declared himself to be born again, he brought with him all of those social values of the progressive Christian movement. That is kind of unfathomable in our thinking today, because of course we now think of evangelicals as representing some of the most conservative voices in the country. What happened?
In many ways, that's the question that informed the entire book. The book, I think, in some ways is built around that paradox. That is, how is it that the very people who helped propel him to the presidency in 1976 turned so dramatically and, in many cases, rabidly against him 4 years later? The standard narrative is that evangelicals were mobilizing to overturn the Roe v. Wade ruling of 1973 that legalized abortion. And this narrative, what I call the abortion myth, has been repeated so often that people have come to accept this as true. Well, I think I show definitively in the book that that is absolutely not the case.
Wasn't even a factor in the 1976 campaign. And you point out there were few Christian organizations that were paying any attention to
it. And many of them, in fact, had
supported Roe v. Wade.
Roe v. Wade, or even before that, had called for the legalization of abortion. So abortion was a Catholic issue. Evangelicals considered abortion a Catholic issue until the very late 1970s. So I was trying to answer this question: what was it that really got them going as a political movement? And what I concluded, and I think it's very, very well substantiated in the book, is that what mobilized them into a political force was a defense of racial segregation at so-called segregation academies, many of which were associated with churches, but also in particular Bob Jones University in Greenville, South Carolina. That's what gets the attention of people like Jerry Falwell and other leaders of what became known as the religious right. Jerry Falwell famously said that in some states it's easier to open a massage parlor than it is a Christian school. Mm-hmm. And what he meant by that was because of the issue of tax exemption and segregation. What happens then is once people like Paul Weyrich, who is really the architect of the religious right, and Jerry Falwell get going on the issue of schools, they need a second issue that will mobilize evangelicals at the grassroots. By the late 1970s, defense of segregation was kind of a tough sell. And so they really stumble upon that issue and come to realize that abortion would work for them as a political issue. And I talk about the 1978 by-elections, particularly in Iowa and Minnesota, where the final week of the campaign, pro-life Catholics leaflet church parking lots. And 2 days later, in those elections, particularly in Iowa and Minnesota, pro-life Republicans beat Democratic candidates and in a couple of cases, a Democratic incumbent to win. And that shows Falwell and Weyrich and other leaders of the religious right that abortion will work for them as a political issue.
But the dominoes continue to tumble. All of this, what we would call the progressive issues that Christians had taken on, continue to fall. So we're anti-immigration. We're not just anti-abortion. We're anti-so-called handouts to the poor. That chain of dominoes is rather astonishing to think about.
It really is. And I certainly don't blame Carter for this, but Carter in some ways is, I would argue, the last evangelical. That is, certainly on the political stage, which is to say the last evangelical in American politics who really upholds those principles of progressive evangelicalism as part of the noble legacy of evangelicalism from the 19th century, and I would argue back to the New Testament. I mean, Jesus was pretty clear about this. You need to care for the least of these. You need to be a peacemaker. These are pretty clear statements. Now, we could have a longer conversation about the role of government and the appropriateness of government in enforcing these things. And Carter actually makes that point several times. He says that given the nature of today's society, it's essential to have government involved in individuals' welfare and so forth. And I would echo that in a little bit different way by saying that, yes, it is true that in the 19th and the early 20th centuries, it was religious organizations, particularly churches, who were involved in caring for the poor, hospitals, for example, but also just general care for those on the margins of society. What happened historically was that the social problems of the Great Depression became so overwhelming that the government had to step in as a matter of,
necessity,
yeah, mercy. And the problem is that these religious organizations have not recovered that function.
And certainly in communities around the country, we can point to those progressive Christian leaders, for instance, here in Atlanta, easily.
Right. Exactly. But in terms of a national figure, especially after the retirement of Mark Hatfield from the U.S. Senate, There's just no other figure. There's another political symbolic moment that I think is important. I talked earlier about Jimmy Carter as a representative of the New South. Mm-hmm. I asked my librarian back at Dartmouth to help me do a word search on that term, New South. And what I found was really remarkable, or what he found was really remarkable, that is that the term New South starts to become part of the vocabulary, really with Jimmy Carter's inauguration as governor in 1971, when he called for the end of racial segregation in Georgia. Where it ends, I think, is just as interesting. It ends about the same time that Ronald Reagan opens his fall campaign for president in 1980 in, of all places, Neshoba County, Mississippi, the site where 16 summers earlier Ku Klux Klan members had killed and buried the bodies of three civil rights workers. Right. Now, I say in the book that Ronald Reagan was a master of symbolism. He could have announced or opened his campaign in any number of places, in his native California, because California was considered a battleground state in 1980. In Michigan, perhaps, or somewhere in the Rust Belt to demonstrate economic stringency. He could have done it at the Statue of Liberty. He could have done it anywhere. He chose, of all places, Neshoba County, Mississippi, and he talked about states' rights, which, of course, is code language for segregation. And what happens is that the term New South virtually disappears from the vocabulary of Americans after that moment.
Would you mind if we closed it with my reading just one? I want to read one quote that you have in here that I don't think I'd ever seen before. Sure. You point out that at the conclusion of his time in office, the new president said he hoped, and this is a quote, that people might say, quote, that we have torn down the barriers that separated those of different races and regions and religion, and where there has been mistrust, built unity with a respect for diversity, and that we had remembered the words of Micah and renewed our search for humility, mercy, and justice. That is an extraordinary quote, and really in many ways sums up what Jimmy Carter's career has been all about, doesn't it?
I think it does in many ways. I know he'd be the first to admit that he regretted that he wasn't able to move farther along in that trajectory as president. And had he won a second term, he would have done so. I'm confident, and certainly he believes that. He also told me in the course of our conversations that had he not lost in 1980, and remember, that was a devastating electoral loss, which terminated his political career. He said had he not lost, he probably would not have gone on to form the Carter Center and do a lot of the humanitarian work that he's done since leaving the White House. So he has tried to be faithful to those principles, and I think to a remarkable degree he has. In many ways, I argue in the book, being freed from the constraints of politics, and particularly having to seek re-election, that has freed him to be more prophetic in his voice. He does not always enjoy the favor of his fellow ex-presidents, and that's because, in large measure, he has called them to account. And by the way, both Republican and Democratic presidents. I mean, he's kind of an equal opportunity nag, if you want to put it in those terms. But he's been freed from those political constraints, and he has been able to press that agenda, I think, and been remarkably successful in doing so.
Randall Balmer is the head of the Department of Religion at Dartmouth College. His new book is Redeemer, The Life of Jimmy Carter. When we return, a look at a new Atlanta production of a classic musical. On the evening of March 31, 1943, Alfred Drake, just one of the many unknown actors who'd been cast in the new Broadway musical that was opening that evening, made his entrance onto the stage of the St. James Theater on 44th Street in New York. The house he faced wasn't close to full. And in fact, that afternoon, producers had resorted to giving away tickets to servicemen hanging out at the stage door canteen just down the street. It's astonishing to think now that so few people were on hand when Drake began the opening song in a show that for generations to follow became one of the most beloved in the history of musical theater.
There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. The corn is as high as an elephant's eye, and it looks like it's climbing clear up to the sky. Oh, what a beautiful morning.
That show, of course, was Oklahoma. The story of the people living in a small town in the Oklahoma Territory in the time leading up to statehood. It told the story of the blossoming romance between the cowboy Curly and his girl Lori, and about the troubled farmhand Judd Fry who tries to steal Lori away. Oklahoma was the first collaboration between composer Richard Rodgers and lyricist Oscar Hammerstein II, and it was a stunning success despite that shaky first night. That original production of Oklahoma ran for almost 6 years, finally closing after 2,248 performances, a Broadway record at the time. Now, Atlanta's Serenby Playhouse is in the final days of rehearsal for a new production of Oklahoma that opens on July 24th. Serenby Playhouse has received acclaim for its outstanding productions produced in site-specific locations on the vast and varied grounds of the Serenby community in South Fulton County. With its wide-open fields, its gardens and farm plots, Serenby seemed to Playhouse founder Brian Claudus to be a natural setting for his production of Oklahoma. During a day off from rehearsal, Brian and two of his cast members, Lala Cochran, who plays Aunt Em, and Bryant Smith, who plays Judd, came into the studio to talk about the production. I began my conversation by asking Claudus to talk about how he decided to do site-specific productions at Serenby.
When we started the Playhouse 5 years ago, there was an idea of we would do it outside the first year and then launch a capital campaign to build an indoor facility. So I'd always envisioned this Playhouse. But after the first year and the second year of doing it outdoors, people were talking about outdoor site-specific work, it being very unique and being our strongest selling point. So going into season three, I decided to really capitalize on this and use different locations every season and start to really choose the pieces in tandem with the environment. So I always say that we choose the environment and the piece of work hand in hand and really choose pieces of work that make sense outside and that really come to life more in an outdoor environment, that we things we could not do inside. For example, with Oklahoma, we're using an actual barn that was built in 1905. We're using live horses. We're going to have an actual horse-drawn surrey at the end. We have stars above us. And, you know, these are things that you could never accomplish in an indoor environment. And I always say something that really sets Serenby Playhouse apart as well is that I consider it an experience. So from the moment you step through the box office, I want your experience to begin.
Lala, how does it make an impact on your work as an actor?
This is a first for me. And I think just vocally is going to be the main difference, you know, having to project over the sheep baaing or the goats bleating next to us.
Your stage is quite close to a little... I don't want to call it a petting zoo, but that's essentially what it is. There are goats, there are
that
sheep.
That goat tried to eat my apron.
Roosters.
Yeah. I was standing next to the animals trying to pet them and make a new friend. And he grabbed onto my apron and started. We were doing a photo shoot. So
I think he was flirting.
I think he was. Everybody flirts with Ann Eller.
Mm-hmm. Bryant?
What I'm really excited about is it makes it so much easier when you're actually standing in an authentic barn, when I'm actually singing about moonlight coming through my window and there's actually moonlight coming through my window.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, the show opens with Ann Eller kind of either mending a skirt or on the butter churn, whatever, but she's outside looking at the beautiful Oklahoma landscape and just taking it all in. And if we were in a theater, we'd be looking at the sound booth. You know, but we're looking at, like you said, the starry night, the moon, the beautiful environment that is Serenbee.
So it kind of does make our job a lot easier in that aspect.
Mm-hmm.
So, Brian, this is one of the most iconic pieces of American musical theater. So how do you take it on anew and try to figure out what you can bring to it that is fresh?
I think that Oklahoma is easily a show that people often gloss over the sexuality and the darkness and think, oh, it's pretty. And, you know, there's like cute cowboys doing toe touches and singing like fun songs. But for me, I really wanted to explore the darkness and the sexuality that's really in the script that made it revolutionary when it came out. I mean, you know, especially with Judd's character. And you've got, I mean, he's, you know, lusting after Lori. Then you've got Ado Annie, who's basically kind of a, you know, I mean, a girl who can't say no. For me, I wanted to, of course, honor the classic material, but not be precious about it, you know, and really see how much of the darkness we can bring out and how much of the sexual tension between all of these young lovers we can bring out as well.
Bryant, the character of Judd, just make sure our audience, who for one reason or another doesn't know the show, understands who Judd is.
He's the most misunderstood character in the whole show.
Spoken like an actor who has got a part to play.
Exactly. I've been directed well, let me tell you. Judd is, he is the antagonist in this. He's in love with Laura.
He's a farmhand.
He's the hired hand.
On Ann Eller's farm.
He's been there a couple of years. The thing about Judd that like Brian said, a lot of the musical is misunderstood in some instances, especially where Judd's concerned, because he does have a huge heart. I mean, it's easy just to play him always mad, always angry, the bad guy. But why is he that way? What's made him that way? He's never really had any opportunity in his life to step forward, to advance himself, to further himself, to better himself. So he's probably doing the only job he's ever known. He is in love with Laurie. Problem is, he doesn't know exactly how to show it. He doesn't have the social skills, the people skills. And then he sees this guy, Curly, who's the good-looking guy. He comes and just comes waltzing in and basically can sweep any girl off her feet, and that's something Judd could never have. So for us, it's finding the heart in Judd. What is it that makes him likable? Because there is something to like in there, and Eller does see it. She stands up for him.
You have the challenge of any actor, which is, no matter how dark a part may be, if you can't find something that you yourself like in that character, you really can't get very far, can you?
That's exactly right. Like I said, it's way too easy just to play him mad, dark, perverse.
Lala, you have the same challenge. Aunt Eller is an iconic figure in American musical theater. Tell us about her.
Oh, Ann Eller's so much fun. Everyone looks up to Ann Eller and listens to her. When she says, lays down the law, people pay attention and they respect her. But she's also got a great sense of fun. In my mind, she kind of was the Ado Annie of her day. And she still is alive. You know, she's a single woman. She's described as being, I think, 50-ish and buxom. I've got one of those covered. But, you know, the Aunt Eller that I have in my mind is, of course, the one I grew up with that was in the movie. She was gray-headed and kind of scrawny and old.
That's fine.
But I don't think she has to be as scrawny and old. And I think she's very much alive and very much has kind of the same pulse that a lot of the young people do, but she has the authority to stop the fight or impart the words of wisdom, you know, carry these words with you forever. And people respect what she has to say, but I don't think she has to have wrinkles.
Lala is fighting having to look older than she is to play the part, is what I'm hearing.
Tooth and nail.
Absolutely. Yeah. For me, I want to always make sure, even with iconic shows or iconic songs like Oklahoma, there's a purpose to singing it. And I want to, you know, I told Bub, our choreographer, and I did the original just like bare bones staging, which took me like an hour. And then Bubba came in, of course, in like 15 minutes, fixed it.
Okay, so I was at a rehearsal of Oklahoma last week when you and choreographer Bubba Carr were working with the cast on the choreography for the title number, Oklahoma. Let's listen for just a minute.
The more we can build in that sense of what, it's such pride in founding a new territory, a state.
Transition into the first chorus. What is that?
The group chorus?
Yeah. I think it needs to come a little, it needs more swell there.
So that'd be on the thump, 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 thump. One, yeah. Two, three, four, here. Yeah. One, two, three,
you know,
four,
even if they
stop.
Do, even if they, how does it go? Join them. Now go, spread out.
So, Brian, watching rehearsal is always an interesting process. What are you trying to accomplish with that number, Oklahoma?
For me, I said, why are they singing this song? One, it's in celebration of Lori and Curly's wedding, which just happened. And two, it's this great sense of pride. You know, for me, in good musical theater, you sing because you cannot communicate in words only what you need to communicate. For them, they have such pride in what they're doing. You know, a new territory, a new state, that they have to express that emotion through song. For me, I always say, why do we have to sing this song? It is such pride in what they are all doing together.
I would think it must be thrilling as an actor to get to sing these extraordinary songs.
Oh, for me, it's amazing. And I'm not a singer, dancer, actor. I'm usually found in straight plays, but every couple of years, somebody's either brilliant or stupid enough to hire me. And I think brilliant.
I'll take that.
It is the most amazing experience, especially with a show that I grew up listening to the vinyl record, you know, on my turntable. To be a part of, you know, one of those 18 voices.
Yes.
One of those 18 voices and hopefully the right notes, but to be a part of that swirl of music and when you're in your character, you really are feeling that hope, you know, of statehood and nation building, you know, I mean, it's so much fun. And you're a singer. You probably are used to that thrill.
Oh, but it never gets old.
Judd's songs are, he does Poor Judd Is Dead.
Yes, and then he has another song called Lonely Room. Lonely Room's a very, very dark, very, as some of the people in the cast like to put it, a creeper song. Because basically it's him taking a look at himself going, seriously, what am I doing here? I want a real woman. I'm tired of looking at pictures of women. I'm tired of dreaming about women. I want a real woman. It starts out as woe is me. Then he gets angry about it. Then he begins to dream about what it would be like to hold the girl and for her to actually want to hold him. Not just hold him, but want to be with him. And then he finally, just at the very last moment, makes up his mind, you know what?
Powerful song.
It's a very powerful song, and I am blessed to be able to sing that song. It literally is one of my favorite songs I've ever sang on stage.
Brian, you have, since going down to Serenby, gotten an awful lot of really positive attention. How fulfilling is it for you to be here instead of up in New York trying to do a Broadway show?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly fulfilling for me. I've been in New York for almost 5 years, and like Lala and Brian, I'm a Southern boy. I just kind of got burned out, you know, and it wasn't that I wasn't enjoying the work there, but the lifestyle was very hectic for me. And I got to a point to where it was just a rat race, you know, and I was kind of like, why am I doing this? And there was just some gut feeling that told me I needed to be back in the Southeast. And little did I know that was, you know, leading me towards Serenby. My whole thing as an artist is if you're not working, make your own work. So now I feel like I'm in control. I get to produce what I want to do. I get to direct what I want to do. Get to work with the best actors in Atlanta. So for me, it's so much more incredibly fulfilling to be in Atlanta And also, I mean, now there's even national exposure in Atlanta. There's so many world premieres being done in Atlanta. So I think that the work I'm doing in Atlanta is actually getting me more national exposure, which opens up other doors mm-hmm. than, you know, being in New York working occasionally and then like working side jobs as well. So I'm a huge fan of Atlanta.
I want to thank you all for coming in to talk with me on Two Way Street. Bryant Smith plays the role of Judd Fry, Lala Cochran, Aunt Eller, Brian Cloutis, the founder and executive artistic director of Serenby Playhouse. This production of Oklahoma begins on July 24th down at Serenby in South Fulton County. We will put a link up on the website, Two-Way Street website at gpb.org, giving people more information. And we also have some photographs of the rehearsal the other day, and we'll have those there as well. As we go out today, let's listen to your cast singing the title song, Oklahoma.
Behind the rain.
That's it for this week. I hope you'll come back next Saturday for another edition of Two Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. Have a good week.
And the land